And I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we've got Native Lights Podcast, where Native voices shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley-Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with translator K210DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
One of the first guidance that was given to the community were these whistles, and we're just distributing them like crazy. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of them in these packets of Know Your Rights with that have a whistle in them. And the whistles draw other people, right, and make others in the area aware, and they disrupt the ICE agents' communications. They're earpieces. They can't hear from them.
Buju, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Miigwech for joining me. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have great conversations with wonderful guests from a bunch of different backgrounds, musicians, artists, doctors, educators, athletes, you name it. We have a wonderful mix of passions that join us, and we talk to our guests about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community, and it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And it is another day, another chance to amplify Native voices. This week, we are taking a bit of a break from format to talk about what's going on in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis, and even across Minnesota as the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement surges in their operations. And it has affected Native American community in Minneapolis. So I'm taking time today to chat with Robert Lilligren, CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute. And we're going to focus on what they're doing, what Native leaders are doing, Native community members are doing in the Twin Cities during the ICE operations. So I'm just going to jump right into it with Robert Lilligren. Ani and Robert.
Yeah, Bujulia, thanks so much for having me here today.
Well, thanks for that. And, you know, we're just going to get right into it. And maybe from your point of view, Robert, where you're sitting right there in South Minneapolis, can you tell me how you've seen ICE operations evolve since they've arrived in December and into January? What have you seen on the ground?
Right. Well, in December, you know, we thought it was bad enough, right? They were here. They were doing some actions and initiatives against our neighbors and friends. But since the murder of Renee Good, it's just gone out of control. And they're rapidly evolving. They move around a lot. So it takes a lot of tracking. They're getting increasingly more violent in what seems more random. And I will say this, Leo, and we were just talking about, I just came from a big community safety meeting just now, and it's undeniable that it feels like the Native community is being targeted. And we coexist with a lot of our immigrant neighbors and friends, especially East African immigrants and Latino immigrants. Mm-hmm. We share space, mm-hmm. right? We share geography, but it really feels like Native people are being targeted in this effort.
Well, what have you seen to say that? What have you witnessed?
So the geography they're active in, right? And so folks who know Minneapolis know that East Franklin, we call it the American Indian Cultural Corridor. There's a concentration of Native population, Native organizations, tribes, businesses, all along this particular corridor. And then there are these streets that feed onto that, streets like Bloomington Avenue, for example, Cedar Avenue, Chicago Avenue. The ICE activities are really visible and concentrated in those areas. And then we have a very, very powerful residential community here called Little Earth of United Tribes. And they've shown up on Little Earth property and around Little Earth property. They're harassing people on the streets around the Native neighborhoods here. And I don't have to point out, it's ironic, right? We're not immigrants. These are our lands. the historic lands of the Dakota people. And since we're tribal members, we are U.S. citizens as well. So we really don't fit into these criteria that the federal agents, ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, say they're looking for, right? We don't fit that.
Well, then that, of course, begs the question, why are Native people being approached?
And we're all kind of scratching our heads, trying to figure that out. And part of it, why is Minneapolis, why is Minnesota being so targeted here? This is the largest federal agent deployment in the history of our country. And it's happening right here in Minneapolis and in Minnesota, where we have a fairly high percentage of immigrant and foreign-born population, but it's still like 10%. We're not anywhere near the highest percentage of immigrants or refugees or asylees, but for some reason it's here, right? There's a sort of a line being drawn in the sand and a stake being put on the ground. And I think this relates to why Native people are being targeted here. And this is a very successful state by just about every indicator. It's a great place to live, to raise a family, to work, to get an education. So I think there's a need for this administration to make us feel bad for that, right? To bring us down some. And then I feel like in the Native community, we really have it together. And it's beautiful, the response here, how organized it is. We have our Indigenous protectors, we have AIM, we have Indian Collective as being active. We can organize and we can take care of ourselves. And I feel like there's something in that that just bugs them, that bugs the feds, They don't want us to be this good, but we are. But other than that, and Native people are brown people, right? And so there's that piece of it. And tragically, the victim of the ICE murder was a white woman. It was a tragedy, no matter what color she was, right? But she was a white woman. But it happened in the heart of a very racially diverse area of the city. And this is the area where ICE is most active.
Can you say more about how Native community in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis is responding?
Oh, yeah. It's very well organized. Yeah. And we learned stuff. We've learned stuff through history, but especially with the murder of George Floyd, within the American Indian Culture Corridor and the footprint of the American Indian community in Minneapolis, we made the determination to protect ourselves with people and not board up our buildings and go inside. And so that really amplified, accelerated this kind of very ordered, organized protection. So when this happened, it felt like very familiar territory. And those who organized patrols came together very quickly at our building. We're in a little yellow building on Franklin Avenue, East Franklin. It houses Powell Grounds. It houses our gallery, All My Relations Arts. And then our gallery director, Angela Two Stars, made the gallery available to the community, to the protectors as a headquarters. And right away, supplies were being delivered there. Calls went out for supplies, became a strategic headquarters and a place for the protectors to get a meal. In our parking lot, there are two spirit fires that are going constantly, or more or less constantly. AIM stayed there last night and tended the fire all night. Ceremony, we had an incredibly beautiful ceremony on Sunday there. So ceremony, medicines are being collected and distributed there. And then patrols go out, right? And we're all on multiple signal chats right now. And there's ones that are very specific, right? The corner of 24th and Cedar, ICE has someone down in front of a bus stop, and people deploy very quickly to that. We're putting out information packets that include our whistles, so we can whistle, which draws attention to the activity, but also interrupts ICE's ability to communicate. It interrupts their headsets, right? So that happens really, really quickly. We're training people. There's a training right now going on at the Minneapolis American Indian Center on East Franklin, Know Your Rights, right? And those are happening, I think, on a cadence of every night for the foreseeable future. There was one scheduled, it was so popular, they put in three. Now they are just planning to do them every night. And so it's getting very specific with the goal of keeping it peaceful, right? If this turns violent, it's catastrophic.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, I'm speaking with Robert Lilligren, CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute. He's also a citizen of the White Earth Nation. I mean, that's so helpful, too, to, you know, to have something to kind of inform yourself, something concrete that you can do and know to get through and guide. Is there outreach to unhoused relatives as well?
There is. And this was a topic of conversation in this community safety meeting I just came from. And the area that we're talking about, the sort of identified Native area in Minneapolis, also has a very high concentration of our unhoused relatives. And they're not so much encampments, although there are a few spots that still feel like encampments, but there are clusters of our unhoused relatives. And so how do we keep our unhoused relatives safe and informed? And it's a bit of a challenge, right? It's a very shifting population, but we have a robust cadre of outreach, specifically from the Native organizations and some of our allies that do engage with our unhoused relatives. And so there's communication going there. I still think it's a very, very vulnerable population, but we're doing what we can. One of the attendees at the safety meeting I just came from said something like, we've been working hard to sort of best support our unsheltered relatives, but she said, we can't solve the issues of our homelessness through this, but we need to really make sure we're putting specific strategies in place, if necessary, to reach out to the community, our unhoused relatives.
Mm-hmm. What are people carrying with them? You know, I saw kind of a lighthearted post. Maybe you saw too, about, you know how much
I'm going to the grocery store, I'm going to the corner store.
Yeah.
Grocery store, my travel ID, right.
Like, I got my passport, I got my ID, I got da da da.
Right.
I got my cedar and sage.
Right.
Yeah. Like, what are people carrying? And do you feel the need to carry identification or copies of identification as well, Robert?
Yep. So people are carrying all of that, right? And putting medicine, cedar in their shoes and things like that. But I carry my tribal ID and a lanyard around my neck because I don't want to have to dig in a pocket or something if I should need it. And then pretty much everybody along the avenue has a whistle.
Hmm.
Right? Two pieces of kind of standard gear now. And then people are advised to at least carry copies of your passport, of your birth certificate. You know, I present very white, so I don't feel like my physical self is in as much of a danger as some people, mm-hmm. some of our darker skinned relatives. But still, I mean, it's creepy going by an ICE initiative, you know, and they're pulling people out of a car. Or even today we were in a staff meeting and all of a sudden it came across the signal chat. ICE is coming west on Franklin. They're about to approach the Indian Center. Bang, everybody along the corridor is out blowing whistles. People are following them and honking, mm-hmm. making community aware. And they don't like that. They don't like to be viewed, right?
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the whistles and the honking? I noticed a lot of that in the background of videos and stuff like that that are posted to social media. And me, you know, I'm in greater Minnesota, rural area, so I'm just curious. I haven't been witness to that. Can you talk a bit about the whistles?
One of the first guidance that was given to the community were these whistles, and we're just distributing them like crazy. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of them have gone out of all my relations arts gallery and others in these packets of Know Your Rights that have a whistle in them. And, you know, the whistles draw other people, right, and make others in the area aware that there's an ICE thing happening. But one of the benefits of them is they're loud, they're shrill, and they disrupt the ICE agents' communications, their earpieces. They can't hear from them.
I see.
When they're being whistled at like that. That's kind of the side benefit, right? And so anything happens, and man, people have their whistles out, they're blowing them, and often this gets to be hundreds and hundreds of whistles going off at the same time.
Great. And have you heard from kids or youth or like childcare centers? I know there's, you know, some childcare down there. But, you know, how are the youth doing?
You know, the youth are challenged. And one of our prominent community leaders here, Dr. Anthony Stately, who is the head of the Native American Community Clinic right there on East Franklin. He's the father of two young sons, they're teenagers now. But he was talking about this impact on students and how they're just kind of lost, right? They don't really know how to respond. And young people can often be more volatile, respond more. You know, Anthony was giving guidance on how to talk to your children so they know what's happening and they know how they need to behave to protect themselves and to protect the community. As a lot of folks know, ICE infiltrated one of our high schools here in South Minneapolis, and it's one that happens to have a high concentration of Native students, and they were just traumatized. They would shelter in place in an off-site location for safety. A young community activist who had said he just happened to be going by the school when this happened, he wasn't sure what was going on, but the students were weeping. You know, it's very traumatizing. And then, of course, as Native people, we carry our trauma very close to the surface anyway. And people are calling it blood memory, right? This historical memory of federal agents attacking Native people was not that long ago. And that's very near the surface. And you can just see it in young people. It's so present.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, how much, you know, youth and, well, I guess all of us are on social media, you know, witnessing these videos and photos over and over and over again can probably have an effect as well.
And it is, you're exactly right. And so right now, the Native community and actually the broader community here in Minneapolis, we're really taking care of each other, right? And it's what we have each other. And especially in the Native community, people just want to be in community. Mm-hmm. On the day of the shooting, I was part of a community meeting where we develop ways of caring for our unsheltered relatives and our substance using relatives. It's a subcommittee of our Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors here. We meet at All Nations Church. It's an Indian church here. And it's usually pretty well attended. It's maybe 50, 60, 65 people or so on that day. And this is while it was unfolding, this murder, the shooting. It was the highest attended of these subcommittee meetings. And Leah, you could just see the first off, this trauma right there. But you could also see people's very, very strong need to be in community together.
I'm just thinking, because I'm also in conversation with my dad. He lives in the woods in an undisclosed location, but he does ceremony and stuff like that. And he was saying some people are seeking ceremony outside the cities. Like he said, some folks came up from the cities and, you know, out of concern, right? So are you seeing people leaving?
Not too much. At least I haven't.
Okay.
You know, and we're a very mobile population, right? So it doesn't surprise me to hear that people are seeking ceremony and peace outside of the city. But at least in my immediate community, not too much. And in fact, since the protectors are headquartered at our building with Powwow Grounds, all my relations arts, that's where NACD's offices are, our parking lot, people are coming to the city, you know, and this happened during George Floyd response as well. I think some 500 people came from outside of the city to support the efforts. But that need for ceremony, yes. And that came up at this community safety meeting. I was, where is ceremony happening? You know, where do I tap in? And I will say there's a definite uptick in the availability of ceremony. There's almost daily ceremony, I think, in our parking lot where the spirit fires are and things. So.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to explore more about how do you not give in to despair or like hopelessness and stuff like that. And it sounds like ceremony is a big part of that.
Ceremony is, our traditional medicines, being in community is a big part of that. But it's funny, Leah, how often people are asking that question, how you're keeping hope alive, and with these spirit fires and things, and it's like constant smudging going on in the corridor and in our offices and in our organizations, and then people are seeking something to do. We're being really clear, we're communicating, here's where you can tap in, here's what we need. Through our umbrella organization, the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors, MUID or MUD, we've been in almost constant emergency meetings since the shooting and sort of, this here's planning in this area, here's planning in this area. Right now we're focusing on food and food access because that's been really interrupted and people are afraid to leave their homes to go to grocery stores and things, especially elders or families with children. Students relied on schools to provide meals, and our city schools closed for several days. They're open again, but I don't think they're requiring students to be in school. And so now we did a quick asset map. Who has what? Who has vehicles? Who has a fleet? How can we connect people to food? We threw money into a hat and hired a coordinator to help us do this work under the umbrella of MUD. So, yeah, that's a big concern that people are going to start going hungry.
And that was kind of my next question after youth is, our other population of elders, how are they doing?
They're frightened like everyone is here. It's tense and uncertain, and they're vulnerable, right? And so there's some of the people who are afraid to leave their homes, and I don't blame them. And we have these organizations that provide food, meals.
Well, what about like medicine and doctor's appointments and things like that too?
That is exactly it. And the medical providers are setting up systems where they can drive and pick people up to their appointments and take them back. And that's a burden, a resource burden on our healthcare providers, but it's what they got to do. Otherwise, people are not going to get their healthcare. We have a wonderful pharmacy right in the middle of the community here. It's called Mishkiki Wakaigan Medicine House. The Fond du Lac Band runs it. It's this wonderful model where they've sort of taken the greed aspect out of the pharmaceutical industry. And so any tribal member or descendant pays nothing, right? I mean, I use my insurance, but no co-pays. I really love this model. Anyway, I had to walk over from Powwow Grounds today to pick up a prescription, and one of the younger protector type activists said, "Well, do you want me to go with you?" And I'm like, "Oh no, it's right around the corner." I'm finally going, "I'm going with you." And I'm at elder status now, and I could tell it's like, right, this is what they view their role as, protecting an elder. Come on, let's go.
Well, that's great.
It was. I mean, it made me feel kind of old, but it made me feel safer, right? And yeah, so he waited outside and walked me back.
Wonderful. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, I'm speaking with Robert Lilligren, CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute. He's also a citizen of the White Earth Nation. I do want to hit on a little bit, like going back to the question of not giving into despair, because even though, I'm in Grand Rapids, but I've seen photos, I've seen video of people still like smiling and laughing and like joking around, and humor can be a good source of healing and connection and stuff like that. Or do you feel like people are keeping up their humor?
Yes, and especially in the Native world, I mean, laughter is medicine, right? And every conversation I'm in, gathering I'm in, at one point, there's laughter. And it feels very sort of indigenous to make sure that we're emphasizing that. And, in the beginning of this latest federal administration, I made a determination, and I know a lot of other people that did things like this, that I'm not going to let this administration steal my joy, right? So it gets trying, oof, at times like this, but It's not going to happen. And so as a community, like we were at this very tense safety committee meeting, and that community meant just now there was probably, I don't know, close to 75 people or so in the room, a bit more. But someone, one of the Native women in the room, made a very funny comment, and the whole room just burst out laughing. And I'm like, yes, this feels good. This is medicine for us. So I think it's, staying in community, staying really, really true to our indigenous values, that humor part, it's got to be there.
And how about after you leave the Ave, when you get home and it's quiet, what goes through your mind? How do you keep that perspective going?
There's almost constant communication going on right now, but I try to protect myself. And, at our organization, NACDI, our approach has been since COVID, an Indigenous approach where we care for ourselves first, our family second, and then our community third. And this has had a transformational impact on our work at NACDI. And the productivity is just off the charts. People come to work, they're taken care of, their families are, and they can focus 200% on caring for the community. And so I take that to heart and try to practice that myself. And I will say, looking at some of this young leadership that is really stepping forward at this time, this kind of next generation leadership, and these are Native people who have been raised with such a strong sense of themselves, their histories, their cultures, their languages. They are just on such solid ground. And I am really impressed with how they're making sure to carve out that time to care for themselves and to care for their families. One young leader said, he said, I can work from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. And he said, but that's what I can do. Then I have to stop. Oh, when I was your age, I wish I would have had that wisdom, doing it until I dropped or until I burnt out, So people are taking care of themselves and taking care of each other. A lot of hugging right now, which I like.
But are people staying healthy?
So far, it seems like it, And the other day, we had a big thing going on at NACDI. We had that press conference. And so it was just a lot of logistical stuff going on and helping out there. And one of my young staff coworkers said, did you eat today? I'm like, no, I haven't. Let me get you something to eat, So people are taking care of themselves and taking care of each other.
Well, as a storyteller, as a story sharer, what can I do better? What can folks like me who try to hold witness and amplify Native voices, Native community voices, what can we do to help?
I appreciate that question so much, Leah, and I think you do a lot. This is helpful. I really don't think the outside world understands quite how bad it is. This is an occupation. It feels like an occupation. It looks like an occupation. So the more that we can tell that story to the outside world, as the awareness grows, then I think the concern will grow here. It's not happening everywhere, right? It's happening in our community. It's happening in communities with certain profiles. And so if the broader community can understand more and more how bad it really is, that's helpful.
Chimigwech Robert Lilligren, CEO of the Native American Community Development Institute. If you are looking for more information, resources, legal resources, or crisis help, you can find that on the Metropolitan Urban Indian Directors website. That's MUIDMN.org. I'm Leah Lam. Miigwech for listening. Gigawapamin. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
That's a pretty noise.
Right?
one of my favorite springtime calls. It's the Northern Cardinal. I always think that they sound a little bit like car alarms with that beep, 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 wee, wee.
Yeah.
It reminds me. Cardinals, car alarms.
Yeah. Good to remember. It reminds me of, I had this like plastic bird whistle when I was little that you would put water in it and then you'd blow and it would make like a little chirpy sound. It reminds me of that.
Oh, I like that. Mm-hmm. This is the Season Watch podcast. I am Charlie Mitchell. That is Jennifer Barr, and we're here to talk about nature and all the delight and joy and discovery we can find out there.
Yeah.
How are you doing this week, Jennifer?
I'm okay. It's January, and people think, oh, not much happens in January, but I'm finding a lot does, both in nature, and I you know, do a lot of event stuff for KAXE, and there's a lot of events going on, too. Lots of winter things happening where people want to get outside. So it's good.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you looking forward to events wise?
Well, KABXE is doing Ski Palooza a week from Saturday, January 24th, Three Island Park in Bemidji, with like fat tire biking, cross country skiing, whatever people want to do, snowshoeing, and there's like a warming house there. And then people can bring snacks, people can bring instruments if they want to just like do musical jams. So like lots of fun stuff that day. It's from noon to 3, January 24th at Three Island Park in Bemidji. Ski Palooza.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Now on the complete opposite end of the state, we have a partnering school in Caledonia. And so I wanted to listen in on their report from this week. I'm guessing it sounds a little bit different from what people up in Bemidji are experiencing.
We have another report coming up. This one from Dan Winkler's class at Caledonia High School in Houston County.
Hi, this is Keontae Jonah Cooper reporting from Caledonia High School, location Houston County, Minnesota, on January 9th, 2026. We noticed most of the snow has melted after we received 7/8 of an inch of rain, which is the most rain on record in January.
Red, unk, care, half, fear, reef.
Birds have been active at feeders. Black capped chickadees are beginning to sing. Deer have been shedding their antlers. Baltic kingfishers has been staying close to their open water at Beaver Creek. Wild turkeys have been walking at ridgetops in search of acorns. End of December brought blizzard conditions. This has been Keontae, Jonah, and Cooper reporting from Caledonia High School. And never stop questioning.
Sounds a little bit different down there than what you might be finding up in Bemidji.
Yeah, a little bit. Now that's the far southeastern corner of the state.
Yes, far southeastern, and okay. Bemidji is, you know, kind of central and
northwestern,
western, right?
Yeah,
yeah, a little bit different. I'm guessing there aren't many belted kingfishers up there right now.
Probably not.
Now, Jennifer, do you have a bird feeder?
I don't have a bird feeder currently. I have in the past. I've had like those like little kind of suet things that have seed like embedded in them before. And I think I should get something, because I've got some bushes just right outside my kitchen window and living room windows that I think would be fun to get birds at. And I think my cats would like it. They could just look from the inside, not have to be, you know, mean outdoor cats.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's let them enjoy it from between, you know, a pane of glass. We got to hear from non-game wildlife biologist Pam Perry this week, who was talking a bit about what she feeds her winter birds.
This morning, I did want to talk about winter bird feeding. And, you know, I've done this before, but I think it's always good to just go back over it, because it's January and we're all kind of, you know, like I said, it's kind of that time of year. And, you know, I have bird feeders. I love watching my feeders. Right now, with colder weather, peanuts and suet, I would say, are the two biggies. I've always had people asking me, well, if you're only going to feed one thing, what do you feed? Well, and I'd always say sunflower. But, You know, in the winter, the high energy foods are really important. And I can fill my peanut feeder and it's pretty much gone, emptied in a day. That's how much they want that. And I am putting out sunflower and other things. More different things you put out, the more variety of birds you're going to get.
For sure, yes.
I mean, that's just kind of the way it is.
Who's
and,
eating
you
your
know,
peanut?
The mixed.
What birds?
Oh, everybody. Almost everybody.
Really?
Definitely the woodpeckers.
I'm not surprised
The chickadees.
Chickadees will eat them?
Oh, yeah. Nuthatches.
They pick them up.
Yeah.
Do they take them and pick them, or do they just pick them apart there? Or I've never fed peanuts.
Well, chickadees grab them and take them away for the most part.
Yeah.
Or they make them a piece a little smaller.
That's got to be a...
But the woodpeckers are all over it. And then, unfortunately, the blue jays.
You know,
and I love blue jays, but you know, they can also go through them. But so I also put out a millet mix, and I wanted to mention that because I have juncos, and John, I would expect you don't have juncos.
I do not. Yeah.
You know, and I have maybe half a dozen or more that are still here, and I'm kind of on the northern edge of where they're going to winter. And juncos, because they're in the sparrow family, millet, crack corn, you know, which are very cheap things to buy, you know, they really like those.
Yeah.
And those are things, I have a friend that says, I don't feed millet because nothing eats it. I said, oh, yeah, there's certain things that eat it. And you have to put out the food that for the things you want to attract or the things that you already have. And certainly millet, when we get towards spring for mourning doves and sparrows and things like that.
Yeah.
But I put out millet and crack corn right now because of the juncos. And they've stayed this long. I expect they're going to keep staying through the whole winter.
Yeah. I had one year, I had a group, four or five, that lived under my deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I put out millet until they left, and they didn't leave until mid-January about this time, and then I guess it just got more than they could stand, even though I was providing them with plenty of food, and I was actually drizzling the millet down through the gaps between the deck boards so
were
that they
you
could
really?
Oh yes. I threw it out on the ground next to the feeder, but I was also drizzling it through the cracks because I knew they were living under there. And I thought, well, you know, you don't have to go far. You can just wander around down there and get it. So,
yeah, and I think they're going under my deck, too, as well.
A little protection.
Yeah, it's warmer there.
I suspect.
They can just get overnight warmer. So what you put out matters. I also put out golden safflower.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, safflower can come in white or golden. And this is for the cardinals. That is one of their favorite foods. And the golden has a little more fat content or something to it. I don't know. I looked into it once and I went, oh, yeah, I'll get this. And now whatever it was. But I have cardinals all year round. They nest right here. And in the winter, of course, I see cardinals every day. They're here. And so they'll eat sunflower, too. They'll eat, you know, a variety of things. But they really like safflower.
Now I have-
and, of course, I get these things at our local bird store here in Brainerd.
Yeah.
Who is also a KXC supporter.
Yep. Yep. We've had them on many times. I have white safflower that my sister was going to be leaving town for the winter, so she gave me her supply. And white safflower was among them. And I put it out, and it was disappearing, but I didn't see the birds like flocking to it. And I do not have cardinals.
Well,
I've seen them once or twice during the year when they kind of come by. I suppose they hear the ruckus of the other birds and they're like, what's going on here? But for some reason, they're not attracted to my place as a place to hang out.
Another thing I wanted to mention is that I used to feed thistle a fair amount, Niger thistle. And then I always found that the birds only liked it for so long, and then it gets stale or something and they don't like it. And I was always throwing it out. And I've pretty much switched to sunflower chips. And I put the broken up sunflower chips into a feeder, and that is the main thing that my finches go to. And I will say that all I've got for finches this year so far are goldfinches. I had a couple pine siskins early and then they left. I saw a couple purple finches earlier. They're gone. All I have right now are goldfinches, but I am hoping to get more. And so I keep putting my sunflower chip feeder out, hoping for more finches.
That's a good idea. I've had the same experience with Niger, and I still have some Niger, and it's out there, but I don't have any goldfinches, I don't have any redpolls, no pine siskins, which I would have expected this year, but no. I have talked to people who use sunflower chips, and that's a great idea. I could put those in the same tube feeders, and
it's the same tube feeder because they're small enough, and the finches have small enough bills that they can pick them out.
Yep.
But my goldfinches really like that, and it's pretty much as soon as I fill that feeder and put it out, they're there. So,
by the way, Little Falls Phenology Group reports purple finches there. So you're not far. They're near you. Maybe when the word gets out that you've got sunflower chips, they'll move north.
Maybe they will. And I did have, I had one house finch that showed up. And house finches over winter in Brainerd, in town, at the Arboretum and around. But I had one that showed up a couple times. But it's been pretty slow for finches. Surprisingly slow, I think.
By my count, I think Pam Perry has at least 5 separate bird feeders. I think safflower, suet, peanuts, millet and cracked corn, which might end up going on the ground, I'm not sure, and then sunflower chips. And I would assume she has black oil sunflower seeds, because that's kind of a standard. Black oil sunflower seeds, the ones, you know, with the shells, that they are really hard on the plants underneath the feeder. And I don't know whether it's because all the squirrels and mice and stuff come by and are rummaging around for seeds and they just kind of eat off or trample down all the plants underneath. But yeah, that being said, they do lure in so many great birds. I'm still feeding black oil sunflower seeds and enjoying it, and suet. But I've got a lot of work to do to catch up to Pam Perry's feeding station there.
I think so. I think we all do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so nice to live in a place where I can put out a bird feeder now. You know, living in apartments and stuff. Yeah, being able to feed birds and watch them so close to your house is a bit of a privilege. And it's really nice to be able to have that back in my life again.
Yeah, we've been watching the birds. Our general manager, Sarah Bignell, has a suction cup bird feeder on her window. And mostly she's been getting a squirrel who is being quite the little acrobat on this feeder.
Yes.
We get chickadees and nuthatches come too, but this squirrel, we were watching him yesterday. I'm like, you got to move that thing higher. She's got it about maybe 2 feet off the ledge of the window, and it can jump up there. And it was hanging upside down from it.
That's amazing. We have both our suet and our black oil sunflower seed feeders are, they're called like Squirrel Buster or something. But they're on little springs, so if anything too heavy gets on it, it like pulls it down so you can't get at the seeds. And it is amazing. I have not seen a squirrel manage to break the system yet, but they are very persistent. Yeah, they're incredibly persistent. It's mostly the gray squirrels. The red squirrels I don't see trying to break into the feeders as much. They can put down a lot of seed
compared
to the birds.
Yes.
And at night, we have flying squirrels coming to the feeder, and they aren't heavy enough to, like, set off the spring thing.
Okay.
So they do fill up their little cheek pouches. Actually, they're more like, I don't know, throat pouches?
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive, but I don't mind seeing them because they're so cool, and I like watching them fly in, and they're adorable. I know Heidi disagrees with me because they're pests and live in people's attics, but I love them. Yeah. Speaking of, you know, backyard critters, we got to hear from Don Latimer about a visit to his backyard this week.
My daughter and grandson are in town, and yesterday morning, just on demand, I wish, a coyote walked through the front yard. And my daughter was by the window, and she goes, "There's a coyote in our yard." And we all flocked to the window. My grandson got to see a coyote out in the wild right in the front yard. And, of course, the dog saw it, and then things got a little, they tended a little toward the mayhem end of things, but we kept them in the house, and the coyote was sort of unimpressed with their barking. I know coyotes are smart as the dickens, and I suspect that this guy was like, whatever, you go ahead and bark. I feel confident and safe.
It's amazing how the critters appear, like, sometimes at the perfect time.
How fun for his grandson.
To get to see him.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Also, it was very much a tangent, but what did he just say? It was something, what in the dickens? What are the dickens? Yeah. Where
does
that come from?
I don't know. Does it come from Charles Dickens?
Okay, that's a good idea.
I don't know.
It right now.
Have you ever heard like someone call a kid that you're being a dickens?
No.
My mom used to say that, like, if you were being kind of, you know, ratty or acting up a little bit, you were being a dickens.
Okay, so I'm finding word historians suggest that Dickens is a euphemism for the beast or the devil.
Oh.
Because it sounds like the once common alternative of devilkins.
Ah.
Fascinating. What in the devilkins? It sounds like something I need to start saying.
But yeah, it's always so fun when unexpected animals, especially ones you don't see very often, just like show up and you see them from your house.
Marshall Helmberger from the Timberjay got a really, really cool sighting of a lynx last week.
Yeah, for several days, too, it sounded like.
Mm-hmm. A whole week. I'm so jealous.
Yeah. You can see his photos of that, and I think a video, too, at timberjay.com.
Yep. I've been watching that video a few times, just feeling so jealous.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what he had to say about it.
Well, I have another question. I need to know the story behind this picture of a lynx with its tongue hanging out on your website. It's attributed to you, so you saw this lynx.
I took that photo, as a matter of fact. We had one of the most kind of fun experiences in the 40-plus years we've lived up here. And we had a Canada lynx that showed up, I think it was December 29th, and he stayed in our yard for a week. I had probably two or three weeks before that, I had, you know, found a roadkill deer along Highway 169, and I've been known to throw them in the back of the pickup and bring them home just to leave out for the critters. And it usually attracts something that's interesting. But in all these years, I had never seen a Canada lynx come in, but this one showed up, and you know, when I first looked out the window, I saw this cat. I thought, oh, it must be a bobcat, because we'd had bobcats before on roadkills I'd put out. But then as soon as I picked up my binoculars and looked, it was like, oh my God, it's a lynx. You know, it had all the telltale marks, the big ear tufts, those gigantic, almost comically oversized feet, the long legs, and the black tip tail. Those are all the hallmarks of a lynx. And he started in on that carcass. And for the next week, he really didn't go very far away from that carcass. I mean, he was visible almost all the time during the day, unless he had, you know, bedded down nearby. And sometimes you couldn't see if he was in the brush, because they really do blend in. You know, the vast majority of the time he was either eating, sitting around, or kind of milling around the carcass, guarding it, you know, or he was trying to bury it. It was fun to watch him, you know, stretching out his big paw and scrape in snow to, you know, try to cover up this carcass. 'Cause I'm sure he was worried you know, that once wolves found it, his meal ticket could be brought to a quick end. So anyway, it was fun because we had lots of folks over. People were, you know, excited at the prospect of seeing a lynx. And, of course, everybody who came over thought, oh, that lynx isn't going to be there. But, of course, it was. I mean, everybody who came over got to watch the lynx for quite a while. And it was not far from the house. I mean, I probably had the carcass out about 40 feet from the house. But, you know, when he wasn't right there, he'd be walking around the yard. He'd sit underneath the bird feeders and look. He was interested in the birds. He would walk all around the house. He was on the front porch at one point. He'd go down the front walk. He'd walk around the chicken coop. You know, he was just hanging out. And, like I said, he was there for a full week. And we were thinking it could go on for weeks, you know, because a deer carcass could probably keep a lynx going for a month, I would think. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, on day seven, that night, wolves showed up, which is what I figured would probably end this. And they, you know, kind of ripped the hide off the entire deer, ate most of it, and then dragged the carcass off a ways. And I went out actually, in the morning once I saw this, I went out to gather some DNA samples, because the Forest Service had indicated they were interested in that because they do DNA analysis of lynx scat in the area. Oh. And so I went out to gather some of that, which was no problem. There was plenty of it there. And then as I was out there, I noticed, oh, there's the carcass not too far away. But the cat was already back on it because the wolves had moved off by this point. And, so I decided, well, I'm going to go drag that carcass back and I'll see how close I can get to this cat. I tell you what, I was within 15 feet of that thing before he finally looked at me and decided, nah, I think that's close enough. And he ran off a few steps, got behind some, balsam fir trees, some little ones, and then watched me while I grabbed the carcass and dragged it back to the original spot. And within 10 minutes, he was right back on it eating. So, his complete detachment from us. It was a typical cat, very aloof, you know. In fact, it was interesting to watch because, you know, it was like at some point you could easily forget you were watching a lynx versus a house cat. I mean, the way it would stretch, it'd get up, it'd do its downward dog, it would arch its back, you know, all that, all those typical cat stretches. It would sit and lick its paws. In fact, it was very interested in the fine fur on the underside of its paws. We really got some good looks at that, you know, and that's what keeps them up is having, you know, on the snow is having that fine fur underneath there. And those feet are just comically big.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, we really got to see all these different behaviors in a lynx. I mean, a lot of times I hear, you know, people see a lynx, it's maybe on a trail cam or it's maybe, you know, crossing a road or something, but to have a whole week to be able to just observe a lynx, you know, at close range was really a unique opportunity and really, you know, kind of brought home that hey, this is a great place to live.
Yeah. Yeah, we all need a little bit of that. Any issues with your dog or the chickens or anything?
Well, the chickens, I mean, the chicken coop I made, it's like Fort Knox. I mean, I don't think any predator could ever get in there, so I wasn't worried at all. Our dog Loki, I mean, we did have to keep him, you know, and it turns out we really didn't have to, but, you know, we decided, you know, we'd keep him on a leash when he was in the yard. Mm-hmm. So we'd take him out in the morning to do his business, and he was wondering what's going on, because normally, and we live out in the woods, you know, it's normally just let him out the door.
Right.
And so if we'd go to the car, we'd put him on a leash before we'd take him to the car if we were going into town or whatever. And, he knew the cat was there because he'd looked out the window a few times and, it, you know, kind of growled and we told him no and he was okay with it. I mean, he's a live and let live kind of dog. So, I mean, he, you know, wasn't too concerned, I don't think. At one point I took him out snowshoeing and, I brought him on a leash a ways down and I took the leash off and hung it. So when I came back, I'd put him on the leash beforehand. Well, I think Loki knew what was going on. So he, when we were down there, he took off running and I realized fairly quickly that he was making a beeline back up to the house. And before the lynx had shown up, he'd like to run out and grab a few bites off of this carcass, you know, when we weren't looking. So I figured he was making a beeline. I could see his tracks in the snow. And of course, he was heading full run for the carcass. Well, as I was heading back up the hill, I suddenly heard this stifled yelp, squeal. It was a weird sound. And I thought, oh boy, something's happened. And so when I got up to the house, there was Loki on the front step, more than happy to go in. And the lynx was just sitting there on its carcass, just wondering, okay, who's going to take me on next? So we figured it was lynx 1, Loki 0 at that point.
Well, I think folks need to go to timberjay.com and just take a look at these photos. What a story. That's great.
Yeah, we also have video up, so it gives you a much better idea of just watching its movements and things like that as it's feeding and doing other things. So it's worth watching those videos as well.
Man, I am so jealous. Mm-hmm. So jealous. I live in a beautiful place that I love very much. Do we have the chance to, you know, put a deer in the back of my Honda Fit, leave it out, and watch a lynx and a wolf pack show up and dine on it 40 feet out my window? No. But, oh, do I want it.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Now that I think about it, I feel like the theme of this week is the joys of having windows in January.
There you go. Nice that we can
be
nice and warm inside, seeing things outside that are well adapted to deal with the winter for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I do often, think about these critters when it does get very cold, but they can handle it. That's what they're made for, right?
Absolutely. Oh, I'm just thinking about him getting to watch the lynx clean its like big old little cat paws.
Mm-hmm. I think that's my favorite thing about these wild cats is their big paws, which act like snowshoes for them, talking about adaptations.
Yeah. Along with those long legs so that, you know, if they do break through the snowpack, they can just keep going instead of getting bogged down.
Yeah.
I also love the idea of like that lynx sitting underneath his bird feeder, watching the birds the same way your house cat watches the bird, luckily through a pane of glass in your case.
Yep.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah. I do really recommend going to the Timberjay and checking out those photos and videos. It's absolutely incredible. Ooh. Yeah. Speaking of out the window, there's a pileated woodpecker just bouncing its way up a tree outside my window right now.
Nice.
Cute. Yeah, to take us out this week, we have one of those outdoor critters we just talked about. It's a red fox. And in late winter, you'll be hearing these guys calling as for mates and stuff like that. Even if you're living, you know, suburban or, you know, in an urban environment, keep an ear out, because you never know what you might hear.
Wow.
Quite the nocturnal noise.
Yeah, that would wake you up.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been the Season Watch Pod. I'm Jennifer Barr with Charlie Mitchell. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. And I wanted to say a big thanks to both Jonathan Jongsma for the recording of the Northern Cardinal and Paul Driver for the recording of the Red Fox. I got both of those off of Zeno Canto. And of course, Pam Perry, Marshall Helmberger, and John Latimer, and our friends from Caledonia High School.
Absolutely.
And of course, thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Yes, thank you. You've been listening to the Season Watch Pod. If you want to add to our conversation, you can visit SpeakPipe. You can find that at kaxc.org. Look for Season Watch, or it's in our show notes.
Thank you for listening.